Welcome to The Scales of Truth with Tyson Hartley.
Welcome, everybody. More than one of these done in a week's span. Now, you know that you can catch me over on Chemology on the reg, so we'll see how much more regular we make this one. But yes, welcome in. I even have notes and everything. Let me tell you what all I'm going to cover. General summary of the thing, the global phenomenon that shall not be named. So you know what I mean. Headlines I give the middle finger to. They're closing what? Phased in reopenings. A Kentucky case study. Memory hole on the California governor's projection. Asymptomatic, revisiting that. Testing kit fallibility, and more on phase four. And then I'll wrap up with versus flu, problem reaction solution, a little bit different take on that, and a New York City statistical inconsistency slash breadcrumb. So let's get right to it. We are recording this on the early morning of May 9th, 2020. And right now, we've had 6,501 confirmed cases in my home state of Kansas with 152 deaths, 608 hospitalizations, 41,207 negative. Now, there are around 269,000 deaths on the planet, allegedly about 77,000 in the U.S. Now, I know that sounds weird to say allegedly, but it was less than a week ago, and I really think only about 3 or 4 days ago, that everybody and their brother noticed that the official count went from about 60 to about 37K, about 60 or 64,000 to about 37,000. And we thought that was great. But then almost immediately, a day or two later, the president said he still expected 100,000. And then not long after that, I see the 77K number, which was entirely new. And then another opening little stat, 20.5 million jobs were lost in April versus 77,000 deaths. And as I said, I don't know why it went from 60K to 37K and then soon after 100K. All right, section number two, headlines I give the middle finger to today. Emergency coffin shipments arriving in Brazil, U.S. News and World Report. What? Okay, now we know the numbers. I've told you it's about 269 on the planet. So my ears pricked up on that one. Okay, Brazil has 212 million people. So they have 6.5 deaths per 1,000 people. So even at their normal death rate, you would expect 1,378,000 deaths per year. Okay, in Brazil, it's a decent-sized country. I suppose it's top 20 on the planet. Wherever we are, it's not real far behind it. 212 million people. For every 1,000 people in a given year, 6.5 deaths. You do the math, you get 1,378,000 deaths per year in Brazil. So how in the good Lord, would this be anything except propaganda, even if it's true? It can't be that many. It's a scare tactic, and it is a headline I give the middle finger to today. Emergency coffin shipments arriving in Brazil, U.S. News and World Report. That country expects not far from 1.4 million deaths per year anyway. And at this point, we only have 269,000 across the entire planet deaths. So some small percentage of those are in Brazil. Okay, they're closing what? You know, this one gets me. I just can't understand how it can be, and it seems like it must have came from somewhere. Whose brilliant idea was it to test workers at food plants? Particularly meat plants. You may have noticed in your area, I've certainly noticed, and I saw it as soon as a meat plant started closing. Now we have a beef shortage. I don't know how long that will last, but all of a sudden, it's the smart thing to do to preemptively test meat plant workers. Well, this stuff doesn't survive in food. So if they're doing proper social distancing and proper protective equipment, why in good Lord would you need to test asymptomatic or just preemptively test a whole group of meat plant workers, A. B, we know overwhelmingly those who suffer bad consequences from this, and we'll cover it more, we've covered it in the past, are the elderly or someone with multiple conditions. So what really just needs to happen is anywhere else, and as we have been told is a smart thing to do, and as I've covered before, both on just the Tyson Facebook page, and I think maybe also in some chemology, the smart thing to do, and the New York City doctors, when they were at the peak, were the ones saying this: if you feel sick, go home. If you have a fever, stay away in these times, maybe more so than you would if you just thought a flu was coming along. But do not go to the hospital and say, hey, I might have this. Can you test me? They didn't want you to clog up the hospitals. They wanted you to go home and wait because there's no specific treatment for it unless or until you have worse symptoms, right? And so you go home. And when you go home, you wait a couple days and things don't get any worse. That means your body has handled it well. You don't need to go take a test to find out unless you have shortness of breath or something else. That's the major one. Shortness of breath, such as this is usually a respiratory illness. And therefore, if you have a problem like getting up and walking to the next room, then you should go to the hospital at that point because you're having bad symptomatic reactions, and then you can have the test. But don't just go there just to go. There's a shortage of tests even now. The test can be best used elsewhere, and you don't need to do it yet. And yet, in somebody's infinite wisdom and or somebody's direction, which makes me curious, meat packing plants are tested preemptively? I don't get it. I don't understand it. So then, in most of these meat packing plants, you find out that a contagious disease, surprise, surprise, has spread a little bit, but you only find out because of the testing. Because even then, what would their guidelines be? It would be, well, go home if you feel sick. See you in, I don't know what their guidelines would be after that, but at least after you stop feeling sick. And in the meantime, everybody wear a mask and gloves. So how it is that, A, all of a sudden it seems to be the pattern that in the food chain, that's where we need to preemptively test so that we can panic over those workers. And then even then, when we do, instead of just sending those people home who have an active infection, we shut down the entire plant. Okay, that makes no sense at all. And the last aspect of this, how much money have we spent on this? Too much. Due to the economic ruin that this has caused, we have spent on the order of $3 trillion, probably more on the way. And how is it that that is not used primarily in some fashion, some part of it directly, to protect the food supply? Do you have any problems with protective personal equipment? Do you have shortages? How can we help you? Because we need the food industry to be at full capacity. Now, I know we got other issues with shortages because of restaurants not being open. That's another whole thing. But as to not even having enough food for what the restaurants need and are asking for, that's some other issue, and it's this artificial problem that we've created. So, yeah, they're closing what? Now, another thing that they have done preemptively lately is tested a lot of the prisoner population for some idiotic reason, I'm not sure. So, again, it's one of these cases. Now, I'm not saying they're necessarily as healthy as a general population in that Yeah, I've always kind of figured, I guess I haven't figured, I thought of it more recently, that prisoners don't get to do things that are important when this type of thing comes along, like take supplements. I don't know if they do, actually. I wonder. I mean, them not having their freedom, are they allowed to go, well, I want to take my vitamin C, my sister sends me that, I want to take my vitamin D, so on and so forth. So they've been actively testing a lot of the prisoner population, as far as I can tell. Now, there's some political aspect to that. Now, on the one hand, all those folks, not all of them, there are some older folks in prison, but for the most part, they're younger and in their prime. They're not in their 70s and 80s. So you wouldn't think that you needed to do anything except, again, you know, space out the meals so that you can do proper distancing and, you know, and then be especially preemptive if someone does start feeling sick. You know, this is a pretty controlled population. The idea that you have to test all of them, I don't know. So this is where we found all kinds of numbers of supposed infection, you know, 30, 40, 70, 90%, whatever it is, infected in some prisons. So I don't know about your state. In our state, we're undergoing supposedly a gradual reopening. And that gradual reopening is phase-based. So here in Kansas, we have a four-phase approach, with Kansas's first approach just starting this last Monday. And then that was, you know, less restrictions on businesses in general, but still restrictions, certain number of people per square foot, and restaurants can be open, whereas before they couldn't even be open except for just come in to grab your order. So now they're open for sit down and so on and so forth. About 5/18 will be at the earliest phase two. Now, for me, that's going to be tricky because the way I read the governor's statement, it was, well, it's not the way I read it. It is at the earliest, A, but then that the governor needs to have some kind of data to back that up, and I'm not sure what that data is going to be. We've talked about population studies in different areas that have helped understand, rather than just testing the folks who came in and felt bad. Now, that's going to be a certain percentage had coronavirus, but the point is they felt bad, whereas those folks who didn't feel bad, is this a more general population, are less likely to have coronavirus. So studies are necessary to understand just how widespread the infection is, as opposed to the bad effects that some people have, right? So if Kansas, and I'd be curious about your state, if it requires data, you know, to get, or for the leadership to feel comfortable with the data before getting to the next phase, do you feel comfortable that that data is being developed? I don't know that they're developing this specific separate tests that are going to show, yeah, not just the people who came in because they felt bad, but properly randomized, get enough people involved, just test them whether they feel good or whether they don't, and then get a sense of projecting that out to the whole state's population. And so you get a percentage, you know, and if you get a percentage and the percentage is fairly high and therefore your number of cases becomes a lot higher, maybe the governor then goes, hey, great, you know what, it's spread through more than we thought. There's natural immunity. Because there's natural immunity, that's helpful because it means our mortality rate has gone down lower. And we can open up a little bit more because other people can get natural immunity too, but it's not going to be this big jump like we thought because some people have already attained it. Well, that's what you would hope, but I am not certain, based on some other things I'm going to say as well, that they're not going to go by just as though the number of cases is the problem, which is not good. So I'm a little worried about phase two here in Kansas. Our phase three will be around 6/2. I said phase two will be 5/18 at the earliest. Phase four is around 6/15 at the earliest. And I have noted that some other states definitely have a phased-in approach. New York has one. Illinois has a five-phase approach. And others, plenty of them. I'm probably yours as well. You can say what yours is. Go ahead and, you know, just go ahead and post on my Tyson Facebook page if you'd like and just talk about this stuff. I will also have some more specifics and suspicions on phase four here in Kansas and how the whole thing ends. You know, what's after phase four and when does phase four end? And that's, of course, interesting. But First of all, right now, not phase four, but how do we get to phase two? I'm concerned of moving goalposts, and I've seen this in narratives and editorials and more than just here. But here we opened up on this last Monday, 5-4. There's no way any data can support what's happened since then. And on something like Tuesday, 5-5, by the way, has May the 4th, hey, the 4th was not with us, the seer. You know what I'm saying? Oh no, if is lisping one of the symptoms of coronavirus? I could be in trouble. Anyway, so May 4th is supposed to be fun. Not so much this year, right? The force was not with us. And then has a Cinco de Mayo gone by any quieter? So back to what I was saying, phase two, you know, we start this on a Monday, 5-4. On Tuesday, the intrepid county health department, like medical director or something like that, says, oh, no, we've had a lot more cases than this last week than we had before. So you got to be careful. And, of course, I'm thinking, I remember, okay, I remember that 5 weeks ago it was, okay, we have to flatten the curve. Remember this. Remember. Okay, we're going to attain immunity. They do the nice little graphics. Here's grandma. She's in one little spot here, and all the people are all around. These are just little spots on the screen. And they would go, boop, 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 boop. They're immune. They're immune. They're immune. We're getting our herd immunity. Okay, so herd immunity must happen, but we just want it to happen slower so we don't overwhelm the health system. Well, guess what? In almost nowhere, except in New York City, at worst, and there are differing stories on that, and I've also heard awful horror stories. You can go to my Facebook page, and I posted some nurse that visited there and was just in tears over what was happening with some of her less privileged patients. Anyway, in most places, that overload has not happened. So if that's the situation, the overload has not happened, isn't that kind of the throttle to go ahead and let it spread? We know what the targeted at-risk population is. We know overwhelmingly it's elderly people. And we know overwhelmingly, if not that, but often with that, is somebody with comorbid conditions. So if the concern was, we know that this is going to spread, we need it to spread, we need to get herd immunity, we need to be on the way to herd immunity, but we don't want to overload the hospitals. Well, if it is the case that the hospitals are the opposite of overloaded, and many of them are experiencing financial difficulties. Now, some of these hospitals opened up with this phase, and in a lot of parts of the country, they're a little bit more open than they were. So that's good. But the point is that I'm talking about these moving goalposts for phase two, because all of a sudden, we hear, oh, well, you've got 24 new cases in a week, and that's more than in previous weeks. Well, first of all, you're not even studying phase two yet because it's only been a couple days, and on average, this is about 5 days. Now, remember, early we heard 12 and 14 days, but if you look at that data, it was really that 5 days was the average. The 12 and 14 days was the outside. So regardless, someone can't be reporting to me the effects of phase two of that opening until about now. This is Friday of that week. Then they can start to report it. So all of a sudden, our area is being scolded for an area about 150,000 people, getting 24 cases, only one of which was hospitalized. So do you want herd immunity, or are we now trying to stop a contagious disease from spreading at all? Because that's not how it works. That's not how any of this works. So I'm a little worried about those moving goalposts. Now, in terms of this idea that in the second phase, the governor wants, now, maybe I didn't say this yet, in order to move to this second phase as early as May 18th, she definitely wants data, some kind of, she has to be comfortable with the data. The May 18th is not a definite, it depends. And So if she starts to test, there's pluses and minuses to two things here. Pluses and minuses to the testing. Well, really a plus in this regard is that when she does test, she's going to find out, like the California studies, like the New York studies, the New York State, the New York City studies, and other studies, that the virus is much more widespread among the general population than just what the confirmed test cases are. And therefore, that denominator gets bigger, and the numerator is the most accurately counted thing. Those are the deaths. And in fact, they might be overcounted, but hopefully here in Kansas, not as much. So the numerator will stay about the same. The denominator will go up. And also, that is a actual plus of what I talked about last week, which is false positive testing, which we'll get on later as well. Because if you got false positive testing, well, as long as it doesn't mean that the false positives are just way, way overboard, then... Wait a second. Yeah, as long as the numbers are not so big that even if you took off the false positives, it would still be very large. If it's both, then it's just good news, because that denominator is going to be... I said that wrong here 10 seconds ago. Just bear with me. As long as the real number underneath is still a nice big number on the denominator, that means the mortality rate is already low. We don't have anything to worry about. So if you feel like, okay, good, this mortality rate isn't very high, well, what helps just for purposes of getting to that next phase and letting natural herd immunity occur among those who can handle it, which are those, you know, regular folks under 50, basically, with that false positive testing, it brings that mortality rate, the measured mortality rate, down a little bit. So that's good. All right, let's go to a Kentucky case study. So Kentucky... this came up because it was something along the lines of somebody had told me that they were reshutting down the state. I couldn't exactly find that, but I used DuckDuckGo. I don't always use Google, so maybe I missed it. But maybe it had something to do with a travel ban. So what happened is that there was a travel ban, kind of a limited one, travel restrictions in and out of the state, and the... it was found unconstitutional. So now Kentucky is adjusting that travel ban. So, but just a quick case study. So in Kentucky, the number of deaths at this point is 294. That's out of 6,288 confirmed cases, okay? Just bear with me on this math, because there is a point. 294 out of 6,288. If you look at it that as a denominator, only the confirmed cases, you get 4.68% mortality. Now, that's huge, right? Because the whole scare percentage was about 3.4% versus the usual flu, which at first they'd say it was 0.1 to 0.3% mortality. That is, if you get it, the likelihood of you dying from it. But then later on, they would only quote the 0.1%. So that 294 out of 6,288, again, a 4.68% mortality versus a 3.4, that's higher. But on the other hand, there's a really only 6,288 confirmed cases. Again, things we've talked about before, the New York study that even the Mayor Cuomo, Governor Cuomo referred to, said 14% of people in New York State are via a study, considered that it's probably about 14% that have antibodies, have been infected at this point. So that's how much it has spread. New York City, 21%. Okay, so that is background. When you hear that there's only 6,288 cases for the purposes of this mortality out of 4.4 million, because that's the state of Kentucky, that sounds really low, right? So, and in fact, how would you get down to, instead of 4.68% mortality, let's say you wanted to get to that 3.4 scare number, because you kind of think, well, it's a lot bigger, 4.68 versus 3.4 as far as a percentage it is, and that's true. But if you wanted to get to the 3.4% number, knowing that our denominator of confirmed cases is probably wrong, it would only take you 8,647 total cases versus a 6,288. That's easy, right? 294 equals 0.034x. You solve for x. That equals 294 divided by 0.034. You get 8,647 cases. So do you really think that Kentucky, population 4.4 million, really only has less than 2,400 more unconfirmed cases than they have confirmed? That is the 8647 minus the 6288. Now remember, so New York State has, I think, on the about 20 million people. And so think of what 14% of that is. 200,000 would be, 2 million would be 10%, right? And then 14% is just short of 15%. So it's about 2,800,000 people have it there. So does it make sense that Kentucky, it would only be 8,647 cases? And that 14 or 21% was here maybe a couple weeks back now, because that's what the California doctors cited, and everybody lost their minds like they were not citing it correctly when the governor of New York City cited it in the very same way. So what is the denominator for Kentucky then, if it's not 8,647 cases? Well, let's remember that 14% in New York State, the 21% in New York City. I looked up some other ones back on 4/17, and I say these dates so you can understand how long it's been since then, and possibly this has spread even further since then. So back on 4/17, it is now 5/8, 5/9, early in the morning, 5/9, in the San Francisco Bay Area. Stanford did a study so they could try to understand the amount infected, and that was for Santa Clara County. And they thought it was 2.49% to 4.16% back then. That's up to 85 times than what health officials tallied. And by 4-1, this was, hold on a second. I'm not sure why I said by April 1st. Maybe it's because that's the last they took their data. It was reported on 4/17. 48,000 to 81,000 is what they figured, these Stanford scientists, versus a reported number of 956. So that's what they're saying. 85, up to 85 times, 50 to 85 fold, which means the denominator's 50 to 85 bigger, which means the rate, the mortality rate. Think about this. This is staggering. The mortality rate, knowing that the deaths are more accurately understood and figured because somebody dies. So statistically, it's much more likely to pay attention than somebody who's out there being infected and then they just get well, right? So the mortality goes down, to 1/50th or 1/85th of what it was, giving the same number of deaths. Okay, 420 of 20. Los Angeles County, 863 were tested to do this study, and they estimated 4.1% were infected in Los Angeles County. They give a range, with a confidence factor of 2.8 to 5.6, but they estimated 4.1%. That's 221K to 442K were infected. So now remember, it's like, well, can the denominator only be 8647 for Kentucky in order for us to get at that scary mortality of 3.4%? We're just talking 8,600. Here in Los Angeles County, they estimated 221,000 to 442,000. That was 28 to 55 times higher than confirmed cases, right? So that means, again, the denominator is 28 to 55 times higher, and therefore the mortality is 1/28th to 1/55th what it had been calculated before. Now, on 4/24, Miami-Dade University, did a study for Miami County, Dade County, and they found, they estimate approximately 6% of the county was infected. So that's 165,000. This is a pretty large test. It was 1,400 tested. So 6%, they got a population around 2 million. I'm not sure how they get 165 as 165K as 6% of 2 million. So for Kentucky, I just gave you a lot of different percentages, right? One was, say about 4.1 or 3%, but back on 4/17, right? And then another one was 2.8 to 5.6%, so they estimated 4.1, but that was up back on 4/20, so it's had more time to spread. 424 is about 6% of the county in Dade County. And so let's go with 7%, just a mere 7% for Kentucky. Well, this is easy, right? What is, therefore, what's, if 7% of Kentucky is infected, well, that's 7% of 4.4 million. That's 308,000. So if you use 308,000 as the denominator instead of 8,647, obviously giant difference in rate. You get 294 deaths over 308,000. You get 95 one-thousandths of a percent. Okay? I think I actually wrote that wrong. Yeah. Oh, yeah, 95 one-thousandths or 9.5 tenths of a percent. So if it was 100 one-thousandths, there's your 0.1% mortality of the flu. So it is right in the general order of magnitude for the flu there. So that's the end of the Kentucky case study. Let's go on to Memory Hole. Now, about mid-March, I think it was, I can't remember if it was March or April, but the California alarmingly said, well, up to 56% of California could be infected within 6 weeks. Well, let's run those numbers. So let's say he's right. So now we remember we've had some Los Angeles County studies. I don't think we've had a California study largely. We've had some parts of California. I don't think we've had all of California, but now I don't recall. So far, I'm just going to call this bluff, 2,585 deaths as of today. There's like 39.5 million people in California. So if 2,585 is a numerator, and you got 56% of 39.5 million, that's 22,120,000. So if you take 2,585 deaths divided by 22,120,000, that is 1/100th of 1% mortality. Now, I'm not saying that's right. I don't think it's probably 56% based on all the numbers that we've seen. Now, true, the New York State one was a little while ago, you know, so the 14% across the state, you know, but it might still be, you'd think that it's still at, 14%. Maybe 20% anyway. Okay, so do you remember how last time I talked about asymptomatic and how it didn't make any sense? We had a prison here in Kansas that was a state prison, and they talked about how everybody they tested was asymptomatic. And I said, well, that makes no sense. And I'm going to repeat why it makes no sense. But in Florida, there's a study done. I think it was the Miami-Dade County one, so I think it runs off of that one. 50% had no symptoms in the 14 to 17 days before the test. So do you remember what I said? I said, how can it be so much more deadly than the flu if half of us don't even have symptoms? Listen, I'm not saying people can't die of this, but again, it's the whole, let's look at this data. I'm not just feeding garbage to you. I'm giving you numbers. Okay, so we had one where, so it either indicates, I said last week, is there something wrong with a test, or is it not as deadly, or what's going on here? So I wanted to point that out. And also, now the next section is an article I found about that deal that we discussed last week, and that, I should say last week, whatever it was, 4 or 5 days ago, the test kit's fallibility. So there is an There's a group of researchers out at University of California, San Francisco, and University of California, Berkeley, and they announced this on 4/27/20. Now, up front, it had not been peer-reviewed yet, I'll say that now, but it was about testing the test kits. And remember when I said, you know, this stuff was rushed. You can look in the literature, look at the various instructions, and see this can be positive also for the family of coronavirus tests. Sometimes bacteria will make it positive and other things. You just have to look at the various ones. But the thing is, there's not a lot of uniformity, and most likely if just a bunch of them were created quickly and semi-approved, 120 available antibody test kits. You also have to worry about when it's the nasopharyngeal, the one that gets stuck up your nose. That you really have to worry about contamination, because what that one does, the PCR test, is really magnify times a million to try to understand, times millions. It's exponential magnification and tries to understand what level is in your system. So these researchers tested a dozen of these tests. I have a quote here on it. Many of the test kits have false positive rates that may exceed the proportion of people who have been infected in some communities. That means that a large proportion of those testing positive on an antibody test may not actually have had COVID-19. Okay, I want to read that again, then I'm going to tell you how I'm taking that. Now, I know they finished a large proportion, but I'm taking that as more specifically because it was a specific sentence. Many of the test kits have false positive rates that may exceed the proportion of people who have been infected in some communities. Now, to me, that's saying if one-fifth have been infected, the false positive rates might be more than one-fifth. False positive rates that may exceed the proportion of people who have been infected in some communities. So, in other words, some of the test kits, in fact, many of them, they say, have a false positive of 100%. So, if we look at that as a denominator, that's one thing. It brings down the mortality to half, right? If we look at it as the, oh no, oh crap, we better institute more measures, then that's not good. You know, false positives mean, oh boy, it's really spreading fast. If you're looking at that instead of mortality rate, false positives hurt you there. Another quote, it's a wild, wild west right now. These tests are widely available and many people are buying and deploying them, but I realize that they had not been systematically validated. We need to figure out which ones would really work. Okay, what did I tell you? Listen to Tyson. Okay, I got a good head on my shoulders. This is Patrick Hsu. I don't know how you say that, H-S-U, bless me. PhD, an assistant professor of bioengineering at UC Berkeley and investigator at the Innovative Genomics Institute, a joint research collaboration between the two campuses focusing on CRISPR. Oh, that great genetic modifier. Lovely. He says this is a huge unmet need for public health. And also in the same test, I'm trying to think. I kind of want to put blame on myself, but we're just going to have to think back of where this affected different discussions, because part of it is that I know that even reading literature, I have not seen this distinction, but I've got in the same article about the UCSF and the UC Berkeley researchers some further clarity on the nasopharyngeal versus the antibody tests. So the nasopharyngeal is that scary thing where they show you the side view on Facebook and you get scared that they're going to have to stick the thing up your nose practically into your brain. So that's nasopharyngeal, and that's the one that's reverse transcription PCR. Polymerase chain reaction, PCR. Tests conducted on samples obtained from nasopharyngeal swabs can tell doctors if someone is currently infected, but antibody tests might be able to identify people who have been exposed to the virus even weeks after an initial infection. So again, this lack of distinction may have messed with some of my points previously. I apologize for that. I just can't think through all of them right now. So the antibody tests, as opposed to these PCR up-the-nose tests, you know, for the most part, I think they can do it other ways, but that's the way you think of it. The antibody test is a blood serum test, right? So that's the one where some of these later ones can be telling you, hey, somebody may have had this already. Now, these are the ones that are better to understand, you know, the percentage that have been infected. So reading on, antibody tests might be able to identify people who have been exposed to the virus even weeks after an initial infection. Antibody tests could be particularly useful for identifying those who have been infected but never showed symptoms. Some controversial studies have suggested that the proportion of such cases could be as high as 1 in 4. Now, I would argue more than that because some of them have argued higher than that. And another doozy from the same article, nevertheless, the team is hampered by the lack of a definitive antibody test with which to compare the many new test kits on the market. Now, what I tell you, you know, it was all rushed, you know, so it brings in the chance for a higher margin for error than you would have otherwise seen. I'm quoting, one of the cornerstones of lab medicine is that a new test is compared to a definitive reference or gold standard, Marson said. We do not have a gold standard yet for COVID-19 serology testing. So that'd be the blood testing, the antibody. So we are amassing data on a standardized set of blood samples and really looking at how each of these tests perform in relation to all the others. Now, again, that's not yet peer-reviewed, but I found that to be an interesting article. Now let's go to schools in phase four. So here in Kansas, I told you that there was up to four phases. Now, what did I say early? Now, I may have said it only on Chemology. Well, I must have, because I didn't say anything early over here just on the scales of truth. And that is what I was really irritated by and thought it was truly lacking leadership in our particular state is back in March when instead of reading the situation as you go, our governor made a long-term decision to close down schools. That was a two-month decision. And even though, even early, I believe even early, we knew that kids and anybody under 20 statistically has almost zero chance to do anything except help build herd immunity. And I said that the problem with that was that she would then have to defend that and to defend it until at least mid-May. Or she wouldn't have to. It's just human nature, and especially a political animal that our governors are. It's their nature more so, more likely, that they would want to defend and rationalize and legitimize their long-term decision. That's why they shouldn't have done it. They should have done it a little bit at a time. Let's go a week at a time. No, let's go 2 weeks out. Then every week I give a new update as far as whether I need to extend it another week. I give that update a week in advance of the old one, you know, falling dead. So you're not just finding out on a Friday about Monday. You're finding out on a Friday about a week from Monday, if that makes sense. Or you're finding out on Monday about two Mondays from now. So that's what she should have done. She didn't done it. So the situation then becomes, like I said, the legitimization, the rationalization of the decision. And sure enough, the only thing open, I'd be interested in where you are, but the only thing that can't be open in phase four are schools and universities. What? We're going to go over it, but again, overwhelmingly, age is the most correlating factor to anybody having a really bad effect to this. Kids breeze through it. Early on, memory hole, I remember having a discussion with a friend where he said, well, at least the good thing is that, you know, the kids are going to be okay with it, so it's not, schools won't be closed or anything. Then, you know, within a couple of days, schools were closed. So that didn't matter. But phase four, our schools are closed here in Kansas, and so are universities. So how? Why? Well, I'm going to be the one that looks towards this when other people haven't. The implication is what? Think about this. Why is the implication that the only place that still must remain closed is the population group from like 21 and younger? Those are the only things that must remain closed in phase four, which is the last phase before you get through all of it, and then finally we're totally done with this. Vaccinations, people. Vaccinations. The implication is that parents are going to, or they're going to try to say it's mandatory, and then they're going to highly recommend or force university students to take this vaccination, even though they could be the natural immunity, and by that time probably will. And, oh, by the way, the other thing, too, about this waiting until, you know, fall and so on, if I may be so bold, is you need to understand that this is like the flu in the sense that it's a respiratory illness. I'm going to make this connection. I had not known this before. Of course, I'd heard, hey, this should get knocked down, you know, come the late spring and early summer, and then all of a sudden we're continuing it anyway, and it's like, well, what? And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, it'll come back in November, or it'll still be there. It's like, well, how does that make sense? I heard somebody say it should be done in May or June, you know, at the latest. It's got a season to it. Well, it has a season to it, and here's why it makes sense. Do you know why a flu is called a cold? And or do you just know why it's seasonal? Because I'm not sure I'm being accurate on that, cold versus the flu. I don't know if we just call it a cold because we didn't get it diagnosed, or whether that's always a separate thing. Well, the reason is that that virus, and as a relation to this virus, because we've talked about the seasonality, we've heard people say this, that it's got a seasonality to it, that it should burn out in the summer, that these viruses that are like this, that end up in respiratory illnesses, They don't like the heat of the body. Now, I know that sounds weird. I know previously I've said, hey, that's where it survives, the body. I mean, any place else, it's transient. And that's true. That is true. However, it doesn't like 98.6 degrees. You know, you've heard, hey, getting a flu is, part of what allows you to, recover from this. And that's true in one sense. But on the other hand, it's not. So there's two ways to look at this. One with this is that a fever is a response, it's kind of a symptom of dealing with something. And then other people think that it's also just the reaction. So a little confused on that one, whether the body just happens to and it happens to be helpful that it goes up in fever. But, some people think, oh, well, yeah. It's just very sensitive. It only likes 98.6. It doesn't like 99.2. It doesn't like 102. And if it has to keep working, your body will go up to 103 trying to burn it out. No, it didn't like 98.6. The reason that it can still survive and thrive in the body is because it goes to the one place in the body that can potentially be significantly lower than 98.6. Now, where is that? The respiratory system. Why is that? It is that way because it can take in air of a different temperature, the outside air. Now, it's really true that if it's very close at all, I mean talking, 60 degrees and higher, your body is a pretty insulated and constantly putting out heat situation. So breathing 60 degree air is not bringing your respiratory temperature down a lot, but certainly when you have much colder air, it's winter air and so on and so forth, 40s, maybe 50s. I mean, I don't know exactly where the cutoff is, but the point is that up when you get to 75 and stuff, yes, in one way you're thinking, well, it's 20 degrees lower, but this isn't just an open system where the air just flies through and, cools you off like a tent or a porch. 75 degrees does not cool down that 98.6 very much. But in the winter, that is enough of a difference. And so that's why flu is seasonal and it burns off, because at some point you don't have that cold outside air bringing down the temperature of your respiratory system. And so really this should burn off. So the funny thing about this phase four is the way they are at least leaving an outlet, unless you say otherwise, is that they do not want to accept the idea that herd immunity, even among that segment of the population that is most easily can breeze through this and just attain the immunity with no problem, even that natural herd immunity is not going to be allowed. That's what they're hoping to do, because one is free and the other is hundreds of billions of dollars. Just going to be honest with you. And the governors are, I'm not even mad at some of these governors. I just don't expect much from them anymore. I'm not happy about the leadership of Fauci, who I think is just practically a demon. Just be honest with you. He's practically a demon. I know of his history from the 80s. This guy, put out on, with his reputation, oh, definitely, for sure. And he was off by a factor of 50. And the economic ruin, and he won't step back down. He's not going to say he's wrong. He is the reason for this. He's basically a demon on earth. So the governor's made a giant mistake, but they wouldn't have to go ahead and add to it with this phase four situation. I'm telling you, the schools and the colleges are still closed in phase four, because phase four otherwise says vaccines are available. So at which time you go, okay, good, that's good. So everything's open then? People can take their vaccines? No, it's still phase four. It's not everything's not open. The only thing that's closed are the schools and the universities, which means, it must mean that they're reserving the idea that there's one more phase to complete. Now, maybe it'll be voluntary. But if you don't have your population studies done by then, I don't know what you're doing. If you haven't found out that 30%, have immunity, what are you doing then? So they're leaving that open for that reason. I'm just telling you. Now, all the numbers say old people are overwhelmingly who is at risk for death. So that why would they would do this? I'm telling you, that's why. So I'm going to give you a couple of pieces of information about the numbers continuing to say that it's the old people who are overwhelmingly at risk for death. This is a quote. I did not catch where it's from, but it is a quote. As of this week, more than 19,000 coronavirus deaths. This is recent. It was like, you know, like today or yesterday. As of this week, more than 19,000 coronavirus deaths may have been associated or have been associated with long-term care facilities, according to data from 42 states collected by NBC News. So 19,000 deaths, it depends on where you put us, right? Is it the 37? Is it the 77K? Is it the 60K? I don't even know. But that's a lot, is a point. And that's not just old folks. That's the people in long-term care facilities, which makes sense. Like I said, the at-risk population is easily defined and easily controlled and easily self-identified. Another quote from the same article. The World Health Organization estimates that up to half of all coronavirus deaths in Europe have happened in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities. Now, why is this important? Because these aren't just old people. These are old people who are in bad enough shape. They can't even take care of themselves easily anymore. They can't get around. There are healthy 70-year-olds. They're still at risk. They should be careful. I mean, relatively healthy, you know, for a 70-year-old. You know, there are top 20 percentile in health for 70-year-olds. They're still at risk. They should be careful. And we're talking about these large percentages of people not just of that age, but specifically in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities. Again, the World Health Organization estimates that up to half of all coronavirus deaths in Europe have happened in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities. And NBC News says data from 42 states says more than 19,000 coronavirus deaths have been associated with long-term care facilities. Now, the interesting thing is that the numbers get a little tricky as to what states have been able to report more accurately. So Kaiser has an article out there, although actually I don't think it was from this week. It was from a week or two back. And it was for data as of April 23rd, 20. They say our data collection efforts finds that in the 23 states that publicly report death data as of April 23rd, there have been over 10,000 reported deaths due to COVID-19 in long-term care facilities, including residents and staff, representing 27% of deaths due to COVID-19. So there we had over 10,000 from Kaiser, right? And then up above that, the more recent estimate said 19,000. So then down here, they said more importantly that in six states reporting data, deaths in long-term care facilities, not just old people, not just those over 60, not just those over 70 and over 80, where the mortality rate hits like 15% or even greater once you're that old. Hey, by the way, mortality rate hits that too. You know, like in a given 8-week period, I'm exaggerating, but you get my point that it turns out that, 80-some-year-olds are also nearly infinitely more likely to die than those under 21. So anyway, in six states reporting data, deaths in long-term care facilities account for over 50% of all COVID-19 deaths. Delaware, Massachusetts, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Colorado, and Utah. Okay, so again, overwhelmingly, it is older folks and older folks with issues. So this is an MSN article from this morning, May 9th, early May 9th. That's a senior care home, source of nearly half of all California coronavirus deaths data show. At least 1,276 people have died after being infected with a coronavirus in skilled nursing or assisted living facilities in California, accounting for more than 49% of total fatalities reported by the state. Okay, I'm not sure how much more I can tell you this. Do you understand how natural herd immunity attained is actually the shield for these people? It does not require vaccinations for the people who are young. They're not dying of this. The way to get around this and not destroy the economy is to have some common sense stuff out there, but don't make 5-year-olds not touch anything. And listen, the parents can do what they want, but the general rule needs to be, hey guys, your kids should be okay as long as they don't have another health issue. If they don't have any massive health issue, they breeze through this statistically. If they don't, you bring them into the hospital for sure. But I want you to be, informed, but not scared. Now we're going to go to an Ohio case study. This was, I say case study, it's me doing the case study. So as of 4/16, first of all, I want to lead with this. I'm not going to give you those numbers for the cases, but more than 855,000 people have filed for unemployment benefits in the state. Ohio has, I know I got this here because I did it on the math, 11.5 million people. Ohio updated on 5/8 had 1,306 deaths. This is out of 23,016 total confirmed cases. Now, that's a huge percentage. That's worrisome, except for that thing we've talked about with Kentucky, right? You do the math, 1,306 deaths over 23,016 confirmed cases is 5.7% mortality rate. But, of course, we know that's not really the mortality rate and not how it's figured. It's not just confirmed cases. It also has to estimate what percentage of people have not been tested yet. So, okay, no, I did. So do you really think that given the other information I've given you, that 23,016 out of 11.5 million are all, the total population in the state, are all that's infected? Do you believe that? Is it the only percent that's been infected? That's 0.2% infected. Now, you've heard the other thing. Some cases 14%, some cases 21%, some cases 4%, but it was, you know, a couple weeks ago or a few weeks ago, some cases 6%. Do you really believe infected in those other areas? Do you really believe it's 0.2% infected? Do you believe that that denominator, 23,016, is correct? Is it really 0.2% is all that's infected in Ohio? No, it's not. It's not. So we're not going to refigure. I've talked about those other places and said, you know, the other thing too is the lower ones that were a few weeks ago. So let's go with a conservative 6%. So let's say 6% of Ohio is infected. So that's easy math, right? So instead, that means that 0.06 times 11.5 million is 690,000 infected. Okay, it's a pretty big state versus the 23,000 confirmed infected, right? That kind of goes with some of the ratios too of what some of the other ones were saying. It's 30. It's a ratio of 40 to 80 off. You know, it's 80 times as many infected as what were confirmed. And you got 23,000. If you took that to 230,000, that'd be 10 times as much. But instead, you got 690. So, you know, you're coming up on 35 times as many in actuality. Let's use that 6%. It seems about right. 6% of 11.5 million is at 690,000. So if you throw that as a denominator, you have 1,306 deaths over 690,000 infected. Now, maybe Ohio has done such a study. I just didn't run across it. So I'm just using that number, 6%. I think that's a good safe number and not an overestimate. If you do that, 1,306 over 690,000, you get 0.00189. So you're coming up on 0.2% for mortality. However, it's 0.189, you know, 0.189%. So remember the flu mortality? 1%. Now, again, I'm being conservative. You know, it could be that it's 12%. It could be that it's 10% of the whole population that has been infected, which would bring that down significantly, right? It would bring down the mortality even further. But even so, it's in the order of magnitude as the flu. Order of magnitude as a flu is from 0.1%, depending on where you look, and that's what they've mostly been quoting. But I know I remember seeing up to 0.3%, 0.3% in some cases for the flu. I don't know if that was bad seasons or just if you take, you know, the numerator as the highest and the denominator is the lowest of the range or exactly where they get it. But I know I saw 0.3%. So we're in that order of magnitude again. But also, remember this, to make the point of where the true risk is, and it's a thing we talked about just a few minutes ago, it's that so many were dead, so many dead were from long-term care centers. Now that, listen, obviously you don't want your grandmother or your mother to die at 82 if she might have lived till 90. I understand that. But to understand the risk and the reward of and the necessary reaction, this is important, right? I'm not going to go hug my mother when I visit her on Mother's Day this weekend. Just in case, I feel fine. I've not had a lot of interaction. But I'm not going to hug her. So many were dead in Ohio from long-term care centers as well. In fact, we have a very recent article, I believe it was from today or yesterday, that was Ohio Nursing Facilities deaths. It's close to 500 residents of long-term care centers have died of COVID-19 in the past 3 weeks, according to data released by the state this week. That's nearly double. Well, I don't need to read that part. Point is that it's 500 of those deaths are residents of long-term care facilities. So again, not just even just regular old folk, but older folk that have specifically gotten to a place where they're not able to... Listen, some people just get put in homes, right? But usually it means that they've attained a certain lack of independence. You know, they've lost their independence due to healthy or mental or whatever. And generally, they're in a different health situation even than those in their otherwise their age group that do not have to go or are not in a nursing home on average, right? So some 500 were died in Ohio in long-term care. And it says since that April 15th, it says overall the nursing home deaths reported since April 15th account for 40% of all the virus-related deaths in Ohio since the first one was reported in mid-March. So let's look at this then. And I know it's a different percent, but for most of us who are not elderly, it's still interesting to look at this. So if you subtract that 500 from the numerator for Ohio, instead of the 1306, you've got 806. You divide that just over the 23,016, that most likely was way too low, right? All of a sudden, we're down to 3.5%. But then if we do the same thing we did before, where we think probably 6% of the 11.5 million people in the state are infected, it would be a good guess, right? If we use that denominator of 690,000, you take 806 over this, all of a sudden, you only have 0.001168 mortality rate. That's just over 0.1%. Again, absolutely within the order of magnitude of the flu. Now I'm going to wrap up with just a few things. And again, thanks for listening to the Scales of Truth. Appreciate it. Please tell your friends. And feel free to interface with me there.
Interface with me. Yes, I am a robot.
On the Facebook page. Now that's there is more than one Tyson Harley out there, so it's the one with the page as opposed to the profile, and it's the one where it's a silhouette of a guy wearing glasses and there's a mountainous background that looks like maybe it's on Mars or something. So it's kind of a stylized profile pic. Find that one. That's me. So want to leave you with a couple of things as we talk about the flu and stuff. Here's the versus the flu. Now I know. I know, people, I know, but this is not a full season, so you're comparing apples to oranges. Well, we aren't, not in orders of magnitude, okay? You're going to have a hard time telling me I'm off or was wrong with this because it was such easy math or I wouldn't have been so conclusive. When you talk about risk versus reaction, think of that ratio, risk versus reaction. The risk was at least said to be on the magnitude of 2.2 million deaths in the U.S. Fearchi said that. And so a bad flu season is 64,000. So let's go 60,000. So 60,000 times 10 is 600,000. Times another 4 would be 2.4 million. So you'd have 40 times the risk. But not quite because it was 2.2 million, right? So 38 times the risk, whatever it might be. Had that been the case, 40 times the risk, did our reaction to this, was it only 40 times what the flu was? Was it only 40 times? No, it was infinitely more. I don't know what you call it. I mean, I don't know what you call it, 100,000, a million, infinitely. So when you talk about the risk, it's really risk to risk, right? Because it's not really reward. It's to deal with this, we underwent a lot of risk and costs, a lot. And not all those, don't give me the number, don't give me the dollars. I don't, the ratio is too far gone past that. Okay, we have people who have now made trillion dollar decisions. And on any planet, that can't happen. It can't happen. It's too big. Central planners, whether they're accidental or purposeful, cannot make accurate trillion-dollar decisions. They can't pick those winners and losers. They can't foresee all the detail. The market has to work most of this out. They can give information, but you now have trillion-dollar decisions. So getting back to what I said, yes, the risk was allegedly 40 times higher than a bad flu season. But the other risk, if you will, or the cost that to address that, the reaction, was not 40 times. It wasn't 400 times. It wasn't 400,000 times. It wasn't a million times. It was a billion times. I don't know how you measure it, but we just literally have spent $3 trillion and had untold trillions lost. I mean, the most month-to-month lost and unchanged in unemployment, like ever, and unemployment on the level of the Great Depression right now. So I really, if you say, well, Tyson, you wouldn't say you're wrong even if you're wrong. That may or may not be, but I'm not wrong here. Well, you're not moving from your original position. That's because I already did the ratio. The ratio was very obvious. It was one thing if they would have taken some steps that weren't taken during the flu, and then they would have reacted accordingly and decided what steps to just tweak up and down. But they did so much more than that. So versus the flu, just give you a couple case studies. Kansas, 2.9 million people, and that's out of a 335 million in the United States. Okay, so you can figure that ratio. You don't have to even figure it. You just go 2.9 over 335. You take it times a bad flu year, 61,000 deaths. That equals 528 deaths. Flu season. How many deaths for COVID so far? 152. Now, again, you'll say, well, it's not been the whole season. Well, I don't know about that. I'd argue. But to your point, statistically, yeah, sure, 152, it's not been a full season, but it has been 8 weeks now, or whatever it's been. You know, we're coming up on 8 weeks. So 152 to 528, regardless, it's in the order of magnitude of the flu. You know, a lot of plus minuses and big percentage go either way on both of those numbers. It's in the order of magnitude. And as at least as it reads, it's only one-third as much. Almost down to one-fourth, but it's not. 528 deaths would be expected from the flu in Kansas, 152 COVID deaths to date. In Kentucky, 4.4 million out of the 335 million in the U.S. You take that ratio times 61,000, you get 801 deaths just from the flu every year, or in that bad hypothetical flu season that was that bad in 2017-2018. 801 deaths. How many deaths do they have? 294. Again, the order of magnitude of the flu. So another thing I want to leave you with, something you'll hear, if you hear some dissonant channels and talk to people like me, problem, reaction, solution. So I saw a video recently. Well, what they do is they create the problem. If they want more control, they create the problem. And then they get a reaction. And then they have the solution, which inherently helps them. Talking the elitists, the globalists, just scumbags who like more control or like more money, you know, like to have contract for things and therefore need something to contract for. So problem, reaction, solution. Now, what I would say about this, and in this case and in many others, is that it's not that they give a problem so that we react. it's really the cart before the horse, or, you know, the tail wagging the dog, or maybe not even either one of those, because they create the problem, they create the reaction. So, do you remember any protest? Please spend $2.2 trillion we don't have. Or do you remember most people wanting to scratch their eyes out about seeing COVID News Network again? It's talking about it all the time. There was no protesters. There was no movement for that. Only after they shut things down did they then say, well, we obviously have to go into massive debt. It was their reaction. It was COVID News Network and the like reacting. And after they reacted, not our reaction, their reaction, then they come up with a solution. And if you ever wonder just how bad some of the corruption over bills that, you know, legislators don't even read, can you imagine? If it's a $100 million bill in Washington, the people are trying to glom on to become rich and get things added for pork for their, you know, for their district and this and that. Can you imagine a $2.2 trillion bill, the kind of shenanigans and blood in the water that happened over that? So, yes, problem, reaction, solution. It's wrong in one way, because often because the media has been so centrally controlled in the last 20 years, more than that, but specifically in the last 20, the reaction is also, it's the echo chamber of them. And then we just watch it and go, why, how, why are you doing? And then it happens. I'll leave you with this. I found this someplace, and I don't remember the date. I should say, listen to it. I don't even think I read it. Someone made a great point, and it was about New York City, but I think it was a little while ago. It was maybe mid-March or probably mid-April, I suppose. It wasn't any time super recent. We're on 9th of May now. And the person said the distinction of there being about 11,500 deaths at the time, New York City, 7,500 of those were of coronavirus, of COVID. 7,500 died of, and then 400 with, right? So this isn't necessarily scandalous. It's not great that these guidelines have said, just call it COVID. I mean, if it's close enough, whatever. Or if you think maybe they were in contact with someone who had COVID, even if you didn't do the test, just go ahead and do it. I mean, it is scandalous in a way, but as far as this particular part of the of or with, it's been a question even for the flu. Like if somebody is near the edge, they've got a bunch of comorbidities, and then they're 82, they're not doing well, they've got congestive heart failure. Was that the straw that broke the camel's back? And if so, did they die of the flu? Or did they just die and they happen to have the flu at the time? So it's an ongoing conversation, but one that I just want to point out the difference of 11,500 in New York City, and then 7,500 of those even just being classified as dying of versus with. Okay, so that's a pretty good little bump, right? From 7,500 to 11,500. That 4,000, that's a 50% bump up of with as opposed to of. But the interesting thing that this person pointed out, you don't have to go find this. The source is escaping me, even though I did put it on my phone, but I kind of abbreviated it so I remember it later, is that at the time, they said also the medical examiner of New York City or somebody like that came out and said the total number of deaths since whatever, whatever, was only 3,000 additional deaths, higher than normal. So he or she used 3,000 at the time that the deaths attributed to COVID was 7,500 of and another 4,000 with. So, you know, to the point of the numbers have been a little bit funky, and especially with New York City being a hotbed. Now, I know that it's a bigger number now, so I don't know if the ratio is the same, but at least of that 11,500, they're potentially off by 8,500 somehow. So nearly the last thing. And then the other thing I was going to tell you is that I happen to listen to Ben Shapiro. I see him here and there. I'm on Facebook. I don't particularly listen to him. I happen to download a podcast. And just statistically, he made a big mistake. So he's looking at the 14%, the 21%. And he goes, well, that's good news, right? Because the denominator, blah, 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 just like I said, right? But he said, the thing is then to get full herd immunity, so let's say it's 14%. That's about 1/6, right? So he took the full deaths of New York State, and he goes, yeah, but the problem is to get full herd immunity, that means you would have to have, and he took that, you know, times six, whatever the deaths were. It's like, no, no, the idea of herd immunity is so that the deaths don't get that high. That's the concept. Remember how we're slowing down so that more people get health, get it in a natural immunity way, and we're being careful with the people who are at risk? You know, so I just wanted to leave at that even someone like a Ben Shapiro, I know some of you guys would go, yeah, I don't like him anyway, and I don't know why you'd ever think he was accurate. But even a talking head is, you know, hearing numbers and doing the math-ish, but not necessarily getting it all right. Well, that ended up being a lot longer than I'd hoped, but I hope it was thorough for you. The funny thing is that I had recorded it once and then decided it wasn't organized enough. So I went back and organized it, so hopefully it flowed a little bit better for you. Thanks again for listening. We'll see if we keep going with these anytime with any frequency. Of course, I will eventually, but I just have to, enough information has to kind of simmer to me, and then for me to go, you know what, I really do want to do another one, and then to work that background investigation a little bit, and maybe also be frustrated enough. So hopefully that data helps you understand the situation. I think you can see where I'm coming from as far as what I would like to happen. I think I've said it very clearly. I will talk to you later, everybody. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The Scales of Truth with Tyson Harley.